Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. We were just having a meeting before the show, just before we were coming on, and we decided that this is going to be the show that goes to the Museum of Broadcasting. This is the one we're sending.
No pressure.
This is a great show. This is an amazing program. And the reason is we have an incredible panel. I'll introduce them to you in just a moment. First, let me remind you that you can be a part of the discussion. All you have to do is write to panel, P-A-N-E-L, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Keep your letters short, keep them to the point, pre-read them, we'll all get along with one another. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, I'm great, and I'm made better, Joe, by the fact that I understand we have a very, very special guest on our panel this morning, and I'll let you introduce her.
Yes.
She's the best.
Yeah, she is absolutely the best. She is one of my favorite human beings on the planet, and yeah. She is here. Berkshire Theater Group CEO and Artistic Director Kate McGuire joins us. We are thrilled.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so honored to be with all of you. Thank you very much. Hi, Alan.
Hi, dear. And I'll tell you a secret, which I probably shouldn't, and everybody will be mad at me about.
No,
I not only love her, but I love her husband.
Yeah.
And her husband writes to us on a fairly regular basis.
He is a huge fan.
A brilliant director.
So we are very excited that Kate is here. And just a little forward promotion, but after the governor's coming on, a programming note, the governor's coming on at 10:30. So we'll have the governor on at 10:30 to 11. And then at 11 o'clock, Kate is going to be on with us and is going to preview the season.
Thank
so
you.
We're
Thank
very
you.
Excited.
Great.
So we'll talk about all that good stuff.
And you have Peter Buffett.
And then Peter Buffett is coming in, actually coming in the studio.
Great.
And Kate can hit him up for cash. So let's go around the room and introduce our other wonderful panelists today. We have Siena College economics professor, who is going to be on the spot today, man. Aaron Pisidi is here. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been preparing for this more than the coronavirus.
Yeah, Mr. Economist, it's your fault.
Yeah.
We're going to hear all about it in just a few minutes. Judith Enck is with us. She is a senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator. Judith Enck is in the house. How are you, Judith?
I'm pretty good. Thanks.
Excellent. Good morning. And we were just talking about the event you're going to have in New Paltz.
Oh, yes. Tuesday night.
Tuesday, March 3rd, I believe.
Yes. At 5 o'clock.
I'm
speaking at SUNY New Paltz in the Lecture Center, free and open to the public.
So we'll talk about that a little
Great.
Bit later as well. And I was coming into work this morning and heard my phone buzz and looked down, and it was Malcolm Nance who said, "Hey, would you like me to be on the show today?" And I said, "Hey, we always want you on the show. Counterterrorism expert, best-selling author, our dear friend." Good morning, Malcolm Nance.
Good morning.
Hey.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you. All right, let's get started. No, we're not going to let grass grow under our feet. We have a lot to get to in a short period of time. So let me just begin with, I think, what there are. Obviously, coronavirus is at the center of this, but let us start with Aaron and talk about what we should make of the economic condition of this country over the last 3 days, namely the stock market. And yesterday, we thought, it probably won't be as bad as Tuesday, and then it was worse.
Yeah.
Okay. And all the futures show us right now that today could be even worse than yesterday.
Yeah, so U.S. financial markets officially entered correction territory, which is a drop of 10%. It's been the worst week in financial market performance since the financial crisis in 2008, and it's not just the U.S. This is happening globally. So it's important to understand that the stock market can be very volatile. Investors can overreact and underreact, and I think what you're seeing now is that when the coronavirus first appeared in China, that people thought it would be contained, so you didn't see much movement in global stock markets. And now that it's starting to spread not only to the U.S. but also globally, that you might be seeing an overreaction in financial markets, just making up for fears that they dismissed a while back. But the threat is very real. And the way to interpret that is that institutional investors, people who are moving billions of dollars around, are really, really worried about the U.S. or the Trump administration's ability to control this. So the economic threat is going to be directly proportional to the length of the outbreak and how far it spreads in the U.S. And right now, there's not much to inspire confidence that this is going to be contained.
Okay,
I
so
have
that,
a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
A real fast question. We're hearing on virtually every news outlet that this is, and you just said it, a correction. Corrections often come when stocks are overvalued,
yeah,
right?
Right.
But this is not really because stocks are overvalued. This is because worldwide commerce is being threatened, right?
Yeah, great point, Alan. You know, corrections can happen naturally when investors feel like, okay, the market's probably too high. You know, corporate earnings might slow a little bit, so let's kind of pare back. This is due to the the outbreak of the virus, which is going to cause corporate profits to fall. It creates an extreme amount of uncertainty that I think we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg with really negative effects that we could see on household consumption, really big negative effects on what we can see with business investment. We're already seeing the huge supply chain disruptions, the global supply chain disruptions, where firms like Apple, who are have their iPhones assembled in China, those factories have shut down. Companies don't have access to raw materials. So it's just a huge production slowdown. So, yeah, the correction is due to what is now very clearly going to be a spread of the coronavirus in the U.S.
I also think in the United States, a big factor is lack of confidence in the yep. Trump administration's fundamental ability to handle this. There's no doubt in my mind that one reason the street tanked a bit more yesterday was the announcement of Vice President Pence being in charge of this. That does not inspire confidence.
Well, and also I would just add to what you said, but that entire press conference didn't
yes.
inspire confidence. No,
it's
because
it's also because we just don't believe what they say.
Right.
I mean, it's sure. the ability to handle, but to tell the truth, I don't believe.
Especially when you have those scientists up there who are saying the opposite of what the president is
absolutely.
Saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, well, I think Kate's point is great in that if you lie, why should anybody believe you, even if you're trying to tell the truth?
You know, honestly, this is a president who has not really faced any major tests outside of his own doing. So there's impeachment, yeah. the Mueller report, all of that was self-inflicted.
Right.
Yeah.
Here is what could be catastrophic event, and let's hope it doesn't come to that. And what Judith said is absolutely correct. The market's massive and rapid correction is because we're not seeing any decreases in consumption. We're not seeing any decreases in investment. There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to play out. And that uncertainty can be quelled if financial markets, businesses, and households feel confident in the administration's ability to effectively deal with this.
No. Hey, this is Malcolm. Well, let me touch on this point, because about 30 minutes ago at CPAC, Mick Mulvaney, the president's chief of staff.
Acting
chief of staff. And
thank you, Judith.
Acting whatever else he's in charge of. Came out onto the CPAC stage and made a statement.
Explain
that
CPAC.
Oh, CPAC is the Conservative Political Action Committee conference. It's the big thing every year. And made a statement that the coronavirus, as you're hearing about it now, is completely a fabrication of the news media, and that, in fact, the Trump administration had taken all the necessary steps 5 weeks ago, but you didn't hear about it because it was in the middle of the impeachment. And he doubled down that everything is fine and that it's been contained. Well, I specialize in terrorism. And years ago, I took a course called by the CDC and the Army Center for Infectious Diseases called Biological Weapons and Terrorism. And they talked about how minor healthcare events were weaponized during the Cold War. This is not one of them. It doesn't matter. None of all these conspiracy theories about this being a made-up biological weapon are just that, junk and conspiracy theories. But the vectors, which are the lines of infection, as they spread out, those were the most important part of our program. which was, no matter how you see it, when we find a point of origin and in, you know, a person, person zero, who comes to the to an area and they start to infect other other persons, that's what the CDC is really there for, to initially determine what is the problem, how far can it move, what's its level of mortality. The New York Times, Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal yesterday all published an identical story that the President Trump, at the assistance of a Republican congressman, had brought back 300 American citizens who were on a cruise ship. And amongst them, I mean, oh, by the way, against the wishes of the CDC. And those people were on an open aircraft with 14 people who were infected. And then when the CDC met them at Travis Air Force Base a few days ago in full PPE, personal protective equipment, biological containment equipment, right? Mask, suits, everything. A staff of 50 Trump appointees from the HHS, Health and Human Services, came out and got on that plane next to them with no PPE, and there were actually verbal altercations between CDC and HHS, and they let those people go, put them on aircraft, and sent them home. Now,
and it's even worse. The federal employee, the whistleblower who reported this unsafe situation, has now been kicked out of her job.
My point here is that base, Travis Air Force Base, those people, those infected people, are now the single, could potentially be the single largest vector of this virus in the United
States. Well, there's great suspicion that the woman in California that is ill,
Vacaville,
is
right
exactly now, from that area.
There was a woman who was not in China, had never been near everyone, and Vacaville is like 10 miles from Travis Air Force Base, and she is the first detected person who has gotten coronavirus with no contact with anyone who was in China.
I just want to touch on Judith's point for a moment, but the whistleblower is seeking federal protection, alleging that she was unfairly and improperly reassigned after raising concerns about the safety of these workers, including those within the Office of Health and Human Services, Secretary Alan Azar. She was told February 19th that if she does not accept the new position in 15 days, which is March 5th, she would be terminated.
And this is in the context of the Trump administration putting the word out that they're looking for federal employees who are not loyal to the president.
Right. But
I mean, the climate for public employees who are just trying to do their jobs could not be worse.
And my chief point of concern here, forget about all the politics of this.
We can't.
We have a massive potential biological vector of this coronavirus, which was we are now verifying, which is done on the Trump administration's personal incompetence, and that they, in fact, may have just launched coronavirus all over the United States with this error.
And you wonder why financial markets have tanked this week.
And that's not overstating
it. It's not surprising.
300 people, 14 positive cases, all vectoring in out of one place with U.S. government personnel who were sent there with no PPE while CDC was there with PPE. This is not
personal
good.
Personal protection.
Personal protective equipment.
So do we know?
I'm the Nance interpreter this
morning. Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, we're in government. So
translator.
Here.
Very much.
Alan.
So do we know what those people who worked in the Trump administration who were there and who were unprotected and, as Malcolm says so profoundly, vector, do they go back into their communities unchecked, or do they have
gone back into their
communities?
Yeah, they have.
And that was, you know, if you want to see a really good analysis of this, Rachel Maddow broke it out last night. And those people were sent as a rapid deployment team to welcome the people back from to the United States, and went onto the aircraft with nothing on, while CDC people were in complete biological warfare equipment. All went home all over the country.
That is sheer incompetence.
Deadly incompetence.
And on top of that, we heard reports that the Trump administration is saying that the medical experts like Dr. Tony Fauci from National Institute of Health, who is so well respected and so experienced in situations like this, they're not allowed to speak publicly unless they clear it with the White House. And I would argue it should be the opposite, that the president and the vice president should not be allowed to speak publicly until they clear it with medical doctors.
They're not public health officials. Yeah, mind-boggling.
Alan?
So I wanted to ask Kate a question since we have her, and we don't usually have her. There's been a lot of talk about what this will do, bringing it home in our area. We have Tanglewood. Will people come? You have your, you know, your wonderful Berkshire Theater Festival. And my question to you is, will you, in fact, suffer as a result of this?
Well, I was with someone yesterday who was canceling a trip overseas. She was going to Portugal. I don't think Portugal has been touched yet, but the trip she was canceling, it was supposed to be in April. People are definitely shifting their travel plans. I'm hoping that our local audience will continue to come. But, you know, it's a question. And as I was saying to Joe beforehand, presidential election years are always years in which we see numbers go down slightly. Mostly
the
on the donation side, for the arts, exactly.
Because we're all giving
because
money
dollars
to the candidates.
Are going other places. I have so many people that have said they're going to be traveling down south to help with the elections, to get people to the polls. So there was already an uncertainty, and certainly this doesn't help. But we're also well prepared, and the thing about the theater is we are a sanctuary.
Yes.
Definitely a sanctuary. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We have letters. We will go to those. We will talk about many other topics. We have another hour with each other here, so we will continue. We have Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Kate McGuire, Aaron Pasitti, and Malcolm Nance making up the panel this morning. We welcome your letters, as always. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Welcome back to our roundtable panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Kate McGuire, Malcolm Nance, and Aaron Pasitti. Aaron, you had one point you wanted to make?
Yeah, picking up on Alan's question and Kate's response is that if you look at the possible economic impacts of this, they're pretty broad, all things considered. So the first thing is going to be, which is largely driving the fall in the stock market, is lower corporate profits. Firms can't get raw materials. You know, from South Korea and China, the whole supply chain gets disrupted. So, you know, Microsoft and Apple are already reporting forecasted earnings losses. Now, the risk if the coronavirus spreads in terms of corporate profits, and I'll explain how that affects the rest of the economy, is that these plants could just shut down. Yeah. Like, it's not that, well, demand's weak, so we're going to lay off some workers. It's a shutdown. So that shutdown means workers will experience lost wages if that happens. Even if there are no shutdowns, the public is going to be nervous about going out into public. So you're going to probably see a drop in consumer spending, which really has been the only bright spot in the economy over the last couple years. Consumer spending represents 70% of all economic spending. So small movements in consumer spending, if people stop going to plays or concerts or malls or whatever, that discretionary spending is going to start collapsing. Businesses are going to see that. They're going to be less willing to spend on investing in new technologies, on plant expansions. And that's a problem because business investment has already declined for the past 9 months. So we're kind of on the it's been a very delicate expansion. And economists have been wondering, well, what's going to be the small breeze that kind of knocks the economy off track into a recession? And we're looking at something well beyond a small breeze at this point.
Yeah. So let's go to the letters, and I begin with a letter from Debbie, who just picking up, and this will be directed first to you, Aaron. Please talk about the impact, technical, financial, and terroristic, on the internet of more people working and taking classes from home and the streaming of events people would ordinarily attend live. Is there enough capacity to handle all this? What happens to large-scale users like banks and companies?
Yeah, no, there's going to be a certain clog up of broadband lines. I don't think, I mean, you know, Japan shut down all of its schools for a month. I don't think the U.S. is prepared technologically, let alone from a human resources perspective, in being able to provide online or distance education if we were to see something like that.
And Luigi writes, I remember your economic expert saying that when the short-term interest rates become lower than the long-term rates, that is an ominous sign. Is this the beginning of the results?
I'm going to use David Soros' favorite term, and that is we've seen an inverted yield curve this week where, I know, everybody get excited. The easiest way to explain that is that when large-scale investors move their money from stocks to bonds, that drives up bond prices because bonds are much safer and less riskier than stocks. But that pushes bond yields down. Bond yields are kind of an indicator of how risky investors think bonds are. So the 10-year Treasury bill, which is kind of the benchmark rate, dropped to like 1.29% at the end of yesterday, which is almost as low as it's ever been in the history of bond issuances. And that rate is now lower than what you see on shorter data treasuries, which, yes, is a sign of an economy gonna miss. It's only been a week. We had an inverted yield curve a while ago. No recession happened. This could be a short-term thing. If the, like I said earlier, if the coronavirus spreads a lot more broadly and for a lot longer time than people are expecting, then yes, this would probably be the beginning of a recession.
So how dependent are we, America, on a Chinese economy?
Super dependent. I mean, they supply. I mean, so there's the supply chain aspect. When you look at finished products, like, you know, the iPhone, China essentially imports the very sophisticated technologies from Germany, South Korea, the United States, and Ireland, and just assembles them. So when there's this disruption, those iPhones don't get produced. And what was your question, Alan?
The question is on China.
So there's, you know, the Chinese tourism element in the U.S. Global supply chain. It's not just the U.S. dependence on China. It's every country in the world being dependent on every other country in the world. China happens to be the manufacturing hub. The U.S. tends to be the consumption hub of those products. So, yeah, really dependent.
Paula writes, I believe Malcolm may have misstated the case. It was asymptomatic Wuhan evacuees that the HHS employees interacted with. The woman hospitalized at UC Davis has been sick since before the crisis. I'm sorry, since before the cruise ship evacuees arrived. Still, terrible lack of containment protocol by HHS also shows ineffectivity of pre-symptomatic people.
Yeah, well, I'll give her that. And but as I understand it, the entire disease is asymptomatic right up until it blossoms.
Yeah.
So the point is we have no idea whether this is a massive vector or an individual vector. But you know, good point. Thank you.
Yeah. And how many people are out there in that community who have had contact with her that we don't know about?
I think that was called community infection, where somebody gets the disease from a non-human to human source. Right, so they weren't interacting with people who were coming back from Wuhan or on the cruise ship. It just
want to bet your life on that one.
They just don't know where. What?
Well, we don't know where. Right, exactly. Right.
I'm just thinking again. Back to the Museum of Broadcasting, they're going to be very impressed with your use of vector this morning. I think
you're going to hear that word a lot.
Eileen says, "Why doesn't the president saying the virus will go away like magic bring us comfort? I had to watch him say it to believe it." With the stock market reacting as it is, perhaps we have a chance to take back our country politically. What do you think, Alan?
Well, no, I think that it's something that was very much on my mind. How is this going to play out politically? We don't like to say that, but there will be political repercussions. Look, this president has been beating his chest saying, me, the real Eastern economy is so good, even though it's just false. It had to do with Obama and people before him. But he did, and he was getting credit for it. And the assumption was if the market stayed up, he couldn't lose. Now there's a real problem.
Well, the other thing I've really been thinking about this morning is, sadly, this may still be a threat after January, when hopefully there is a new president in 2021. And so I'm focused on, of the current Democratic field, who can I envision handling a crisis like this the best?
So who?
I have different views on each of them. I think not good for Buttigieg because I think he's inexperienced. I think Joe Biden would rely on science and the medical experts, which is the most important thing. But I also don't think he would necessarily think outside the box, come up with new ideas and new approaches. I think he'll defer to the medical experts. That might be enough. I think someone like Elizabeth Warren, it would shine in a moment like this because she would listen to the medical experts and the science. She would be very analytical. I think she would endeavor public trust. Bloomberg has a lot of contact with John Hopkins. He has a history of really focusing not just on obesity issues, but public health issues. Bernie, maybe not the best moment here. I will get letters. I really like Bernie. I think he focuses on healthcare in an important way. I think he would bring a perspective where he looks out for everyone, particularly people who can't afford a potential vaccine. So I'm not saying one or the other. And I'm not going to say anything about Tom Steyer and his tie. But I think when you're thinking of who to support in primaries, you have to have a vision of how will they handle a situation like
don't
this.
I'm sorry. Don't you think this is a time that they have to tell us? In other words, it seems to me that that's what this is all about, and it is not what I'm hearing.
Sure.
That's so true. And, you think of that debate was Tuesday night, and it was not major.
It wasn't major, but Bloomberg was the first to raise it.
Well, when it was brought up, he was told that was going to be discussed later.
It was going to be discussed later. Right.
And they could we talk about soda pop?
Right. And they never got to climate change.
Well, it was bad. It was a mess.
It was the worst CBS.
Let me go ahead for a minute, because as the middle-aged African-American man in the room, Biden's already done this. We had the Ebola outbreak, so how you can say that he's not going to be as good as Elizabeth Warren? He knows all the levers. It's already pulled the levers. I need someone who is going to be able to be president on day one with no learning curve, and he's the only guy who's qualified.
So do you think that's not Bernie? Hire people.
Bernie?
Do you think that's not Bernie?
Bernie named two post offices out of the seven pieces of his legislation he passed in 30 years. No, you can't get Medicare for all in an hour, right? It's not going to happen. You have to be able to run the government first.
I mean, most of this work, quite honestly, should be done by the public health experts inside and outside government. Any one of these Democrats would be tremendously
still
more
effective. Still got to hire the people who were all purged.
Exactly. I think there's 600 shortages in that department.
And the president said, we can hire them when we need them. No, that's not how it works.
No. Yeah.
It takes a long time to bring people on board, and you want the best people.
And here's the point. We need them now. In other words, your point is extremely well taken.
And here's what you're up against. I just got this on Twitter. Don Trump Jr. was on Fox and Friends this morning, and he said Democrats hoped coronavirus, quote, comes here and kills millions of people that they can end Donald Trump's streak of winning. 40% of this country will believe that in a matter of days. And they will take political decisions which will harm our fellow citizens because they will not view this as a national health crisis, but as a political thing. And God knows where talk like this could lead.
Which brings me to Mitchell's letter, who says, the doomsday group continues not to disappoint today. The quarantine order has been in effect since late January. The quarantine orders will expand as the needs arise. Please stay up to date with your facts. So that is from our audience.
I want Mitchell to have a good day.
Yeah. I think I can speak for all of us in saying no one wants this to get bad and get worse.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but is it safe to say that we, as of right now, the Dow is down 700 points, that is a concern about this issue that goes, as Malcolm said earlier, a world concern about this issue that goes beyond a couple of Democrats?
Well, I think that quite frankly, if you take a look at how money is divided in the United States, Republicans tend, not always, but tend to have more money than Democrats do. And this is hitting them in a place where they really exist, because this has been pointed out on this show so many times, not everybody is in the stock market, but I'll tell you who is.
So this bears repeating multiple times. The richest 10% of the population owns 90% of all stock. It's not until you get to the richest 50% of the population where most stock wealth is contained. So half of the population has no financial stake in movements in stock prices. And that includes retirement funds. They are just completely out of the game.
Yeah.
So movements in the stock market, like I said, you know, if you're going to focus on how much markets go up or down, that's a pretty incomplete indicator of the overall health of the economy. It's a good indicator about the expected path of future corporate earnings, and, you know, what institutional investors are thinking might be growth sectors. Judith, do you want to talk about the stocks that have gone up during this period?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. In the last few days, the stay-at-home stocks have gone up, like Netflix and Peloton. People are not going to want to go to the gym as much. Clorox is up. 3M is up because they make the more sophisticated masks. So I guess if you're in the stock market...
You know who doesn't care about stock prices or the global market? A global pandemic disease.
Yeah. Exactly.
It does not care. It is the great equalizer of this story. What I'm afraid of as a person who deals in national security crises as a job is that there are people in this country that will help facilitate by doing nothing, right, through passive means, the spread of this thing. And then when it gets to the point, Mick Mulvaney also said this morning, maybe some schools will have to be closed. This isn't a snow day. The reason they closed those schools is because it's not the kids. The kids aren't getting infected. It's the parents bringing them and interacting. I want you to think about New York State. If it gets to the point where...
And the subway system in New York City.
Right. And look, the mask isn't necessarily going to help you. It's going to prevent you from transmitting
it. Which is good.
Just think about the disruption on a country of our scale if it gets to the level of China. And you were talking about mass hysteria.
In reaction to the doomsday comment, I mean, my world is different than yours. I don't live in stock markets, and I sit at, you know, getting my hair done, and I'm so relieved because the hairdressers are all saying, I don't read the news anymore, and they really don't. But they do read about this virus, and they are concerned about their kids getting sick, and the hospitals in Berkshire County are full of flu victims. Mm. And so for these flu victims to all of a sudden come in touch with such a disease as this, there's a level of panic out there that hits in a very different way, I think.
We have a lot to get to. We will continue our conversation. I just have to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Kate McGuire, Aaron Pasitti, and Malcolm Nance make up our group. A fantastic panel, as always, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. A reminder that Governor Andrew Cuomo will join Alan at 10:30 this morning. Back to letters. Jamie writes, once the virus hit Italy, it was out. The problem with this virus is not the death rate from infection, but the need of many people to be on respirator ventilators to recover. Do we have 100 million respirators ready to go? No. While spring is coming here in the southern hemisphere, it will soon be fall. The virus traveled to San Paolo from Italy. Consider the state of Venezuela healthcare system. This story has just begun, according to Jamie. We go then to this letter from Molly, who says, the first thing that occurred to me when the president appointed Mike Pence, this is his way of jettisoning Mike so he can bring Nikki Haley on as his running mate. I think you made that point, Alan, didn't you? Which just is to say that Trump knows that this is going to be a disaster, one that he can pin on Pence's mismanagement, thinking he, Donald, can avoid personal responsibility.
Good luck with that.
I believe it, though, and it's disgraceful, disgraceful. We are in danger, and I'm sorry. Yeah. I sound a little hyperbolic when I'm on TV and everywhere because my career job was to warn you of threats well before they manifested themselves. And now we are in a situation where we can all see the manifestation, but that the White House and these staffers really don't intend to manage this the way that it would save every American citizen or mitigate the risk.
And they wasted valuable time.
They don't care, though.
When, I mean, they knew about this months ago, and yeah, maybe they did one quarantine, but they were not educating the public. They were not putting medical systems in place. I mean, it's really valuable time that they lost.
I'm still reeling from the Eric Trump. It was Eric, right?
Yeah.
It's always Eric.
That is unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable. Can you repeat it again? What did he say?
All right.
Well, will you find it?
Here it is. He wrote, he accused Democrats of hoping coronavirus, quote, comes here and kills millions of people so they can end Donald Trump's streak of winning, unquote.
What an SOB.
Well, the point is that none of these people care about the nation at large. I get afraid for all of my fellow citizens when there's a threat or a risk out there. And I'm sure. To be honest, I've got that little tingle of fear because having gone through biological weapons training and seeing how medical vectors can flash through a society. This is a global pandemic, which may be on the scale of the Spanish flu of 1918, but with maybe a little less virility.
Could
but
become a global pandemic.
2% is the rate that it's of mortality on this. Well, let's do the math. What's 2% of 340 million people? 6,800,000.
Right. I said that to my husband the other day. Yeah. It's 2%. That's not that much. Right. And he went, Kate, of a world population, that's a lot of people.
The United States.
Yeah, when you do the math, that's when it makes you stop.
That's the USA.
And it's older people, little babies, people with compromised immune system, people going through chemotherapy. So I tick off that list. That's a lot of people in our personal lives.
I want to say that when Judith started to talk about the candidates and their reaction and how they would handle coronavirus, Judith started off by saying, I know I'm going to get letters on this. You did.
I know.
Trisha says, why did you leave out Amy Klobuchar? Oh, she's very competent and can handle an emergency.
I forgot.
And Tulsi.
Sorry.
Okay, that's all right. And Tulsi. We got this from Christopher, who says, this argument is disingenuous and or naive. It's at very least a display of a lack of knowledge around how legislating works. Bernie has sponsored or co-sponsored over 400 pieces of proposed legislation. This is to you, Malcolm.
Yeah.
What percentage of and I know this because the subject line is Bernie's post office. Bernie has sponsored or co-sponsored over 400 pieces of proposed legislation. What percentage of past legislation do you deem acceptable to be ready for the Oval Office?
More than 7. Next.
But he has built a career pointing out the importance of universal access to health care. And he does really go after Big Pharma. And that's an important issue here. Companies are not investing money in vaccines because of the cost.
And the United States government is not investing in education and infrastructure. We're allowing extremely wealthy corporations to pay a minimum wage, which is actually a poverty wage. So independent of Bernie's legislative record, the fact that he was the first candidate to bring these issues to a national scale gives him an incredible amount of credibility, and he's consistent about that from when he was the mayor of Burlington.
Wonderful, but here's a key point. We are about to go, if let's say this pandemic really starts to come and hit this country, Big Pharma is going to be the number one weapon that we're going to need out there. Lot of our pharma is not coming. The sub components are no longer coming from China. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to stand up, our own U.S. industry to provide our own protective equipment, to provide our own medicines. So if he gets on the stage and he starts dissing Big Pharma as we're about to go into a coronavirus.
I disagree. I don't want him dissing Big Pharma. I want him holding Big Pharma accountable for not putting money into vaccine development unless they can make a lot of money on it.
Right.
That is a problem with our healthcare
system.
Which is what
on,
Nancy Pelosi brought up yesterday as she was speaking.
Okay. Yay.
Okay. I'm just Just say, okay, we got this question. This is a letter from Alice, which I believe is a gift to Judith Hank. 70 degrees in Antarctica may feel less immediate than the spread of the coronavirus, but is it? Massive ice melting at these temperatures means massive displacement of populations around the world. How are we preparing for this? We're not. Please comment on how we move to the new world order needed for human survival. A stock market probably does not have a place.
Well, I think that's an important perspective, you know, and we tend to focus on the immediate threats, and this is a very legitimate immediate threat, but the numbers on climate change get worse with every passing month. The Trump administration, in order to punish New York City, just announced that they're pulling funding for major resiliency infrastructure in the city. You know, there's still a march toward burning fossil fuels. The situation in Antarctica is incredibly serious, and we have to keep our eye on these long-term threats that are not really long-term. They don't feel as imminent as the virus, but there are people struggling with the impacts of climate change every single day.
Joe, very quickly, I want you to know that I'm getting a tremendous amount of Bernie mail. There are those people, as we just heard, who love him, who think he's the savior, basically, who will change the world for the better. And then there are those people who are absolutely, and both sides are passionate about this. I believe none of it is nonsense. They're just simply saying Bernie is going to lose the election. And as a result, we're going to have four more years of what we've been talking about today. And you hear it on both sides, and you hear it passionately. And I think all those people who are writing me are honest about it.
We got a letter from Mike. We'll end here before we go to a break. And this is taking the panel to task. I think the media is purposely giving Trump a hard time in coronavirus because it's election season. If he did a full-on travel ban, you would be calling him xenophobic and racist. It's a lose-lose for him no matter what he does.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, sure. Can you respond in 20 seconds?
Yes. Okay. I'm begging you, as a former lifelong intelligence professional, I only care about the well-being of the people of this country. I do not care who's sitting in that chair right now. This is real. It's extant. It's coming. Deal with it.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll have more letters, and then the governor on with Alan coming up at 10:30 this morning. We'll be right back. I always joke when we're on the show that during the breaks we have these really scintillating, very exciting, very funny. Often
it's actually a much better show on the break.
Yeah, and
don't tell them that.
But over the last 5 minutes, I will say I was crushingly disappointed because everyone here was just doing math. Anyway, we got a letter. This is what started at Gus. She writes and says, Malcolm and Judith, isn't the mortality rate 2% for those who contract the disease? It isn't the whole population, is it?
You're all going to get the disease, according to one of the former directors of the CDC, is that you have a very high likelihood if it becomes a global pandemic.
And for most people, it'll be flu symptoms.
Right.
But for people who are much older.
But the 2% mortality rate?
We're checking.
Aaron?
Yeah, no, I'm looking at it.
Okay.
Also, if you don't have a flu shot this season, you can get both.
Right. I think it's 2% of the people that get coronavirus.
Right. Yes.
Well,
that was my understanding, but the letter writer is asking something different.
No, they're asking exactly that.
2% who get it.
Yes. Okay.
And we don't know how many people are going to get it.
No, the source that I had was on The Daily and the Scientific.
The New York Times podcast.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the New York Times podcast. I think it was yesterday or the day
before. But it's almost impossible, Malcolm, to predict how many people will get it in the United States.
Sure. Mm. Depending on whether you're in isolation, depending on whether
it's of the people
who contract the disease. Okay. Yeah. Gus, we have corrected it. Thank you very much for bringing that to our attention. Very, very, very good point. We go to Barry, who says the coronavirus is Mother Earth's latest attempt to rid herself of the cancerous infection called the human race. At nearly 73, I used to be a perpetual optimist. Clearly, that's worn off. But in the last 20 years or so, I have lost faith in the ability of the human race to overcome the dire consequences of our unacknowledged addiction to oil and our unrestrained destruction of the environment in our quest for more.
I don't want that person to be such a pessimist. There is a young generation coming up that holds so much optimism and a desire for change. And I believe these people are going to vote. I have never talked to young people like I talk to them now. And they are out there. They are active. Mm-hmm. We work with 13,000 school children. And all these kids can respond to me when I talk about politics. All different ages. College age kids, recent graduates who are suffering with the college debt. Mm-hmm. They have a very different perspective than the hairdressers that I was talking about.
Well, no, that's a really good point.
You know, you tack on to that the rising employment in the gig or contract economy. Mm-hmm. Those are jobs that provide no benefits, including health care and retirement savings. So you for younger people, the student loan debt, the lack of health care, low wages, lack of retirement savings. Economically, this is just crippling a generation. The current, the upcoming generation is going to be the first generation in U.S. economic history to experience a lower standard of living than their parents.
Jim writes, and I'm reading this because I think we've made this point, but I just want to make it again, so we make it again. You may not want the disaster, but it sounds like if it works to get Trump out, you're willing to take that risk.
No.
You may not feel that way, but that's what it sounds
like. Well, we don't want it to sound that way. That is
No, what I want is competent response to a threat which will affect every American. That's it. I don't care who's there. I'm just not seeing the competence right now. I just don't feel good about it. You cannot be so blind to Trump that you think that everything from, you know, the traffic lights changing a second early to coronavirus being a conspiracy against Donald Trump.
Well, the one thing I would invite the listener to do is go back to the news conference in the White House 2 days ago, see what the medical experts said, and then see President Trump contradicting them and being really, quite honestly, borderline incoherent. And, you know, we learned that in California today, 8,400 people are being monitored for the disease. And the president was talking about, well, it might be 10 people, it might be 2 people, it might get worse, it might get better. And, you know, it was as if he didn't listen to the medical experts who were standing right next to him. It does not inspire confidence.
Casey writes, Trump received criticism from bureaucrats and diplomats as recently as January 31st, when he declared the coronavirus as, quote, a public health emergency. Senator Schumer criticized Trump for overreacting when Trump very early on closed off travel. Over 50 countries now have the virus. Is it the fault of leaders in all those countries? Each day we learn more and more about the virus, like that it can be asymptomatic and will be hard to stop despite anyone's best efforts. Everyone criticizing, no one with solutions. That is from Casey.
Government has to lead the way for this pandemic response. And if they don't have the solutions, if they're saying they have it contained, it'll burn out in sunlight in April, then we're dealing with a level of incompetence that will affect you, your life, your family, and your children. We should never be satisfied with that.
This is why we have a Centers for Disease Control.
Oh, yeah,
like, that's
guys.
The whole point, and that's why you fund these organizations to prepare for an unlikely but catastrophic event.
And
like, that's the whole point.
And you keep them funded. You
right,
don't close
exactly.
the key offices. I think in terms of where we are today, I think states are going to have to be in the lead. I think large cities, colleges, and businesses. I think this is going to be kind of, you know, you're kind of on your own with,
right.
And you don't rely on tremendous support from the federal government. Congress is passing a new appropriation. That's good. We need money flowing. But quite honestly, and I'm sure one reason Governor Cuomo wants to be on with Alan this morning is to talk about New York State's preparation and New York City's preparation. And I think that's where the focus should be.
We got this letter from our friend Tony, who says, I have friends with a medium-sized electronics company in Berkeley, California. They have been hit very hard by Trump's tariffs, and now with the virus, their extensive Chinese imports are beginning to make it worse. They are talking about layoffs already. It scares me to hear from Aaron that some companies could close, but I know that this is true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I want to point out one other thing is that, so there's the public health response that we've been talking about, but then there's the economic response that compounds the pain. And The normal tools of economic policy, which is, you know, government spending and tax cuts to stimulate an economy, or the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, don't work under these conditions. If a factory shuts down, they shut down. No amount of interest rate cuts or corporate tax cuts or cash infusions from the government into these sectors is going to get these factories to reopen. That's something totally different than policymakers are used to handling.
And remember, we're not facing this alone. I mean, this is a moment for diplomacy. How much time do you think Mike Pompeo is spending talking to his counterparts in other countries about this? This is when the corrosive effect of attacking the State Department, not funding the CDC, is going to have a real-life impact.
I mean, we have come to a place, though, in conversation, which sort of is the world that I come from,
right,
where when we're told by Mr. Trump Jr. or Rush Limbaugh or Mike Mulvaney that we wish for members of our own family to become ill because we dislike the president so much, I mean, that's not even logical. It just doesn't make sense if you think about it.
Right.
Well, they live in that ideological bubble where our reality, the reality as it is known by virtually everyone, does not intrude. And in their world, again, this is where it becomes very dangerous. And I've written several books about it. They will have a rally in a city that may have a massive coronavirus infection and think, I'm not going to stop going there because that's just some liberal claptrap.
Yes.
The reality of this is what it is. As we say in the intelligence community, it's ground truth. And we just have to be cognizant of that to deal with it.
I'm sorry, what? I'm sorry. Okay. Georgette writes and says, what do we do about the people who don't have paid vacation? What do we do about people who don't have paid vacation? How do they survive under quarantine? How about people who cannot afford to go to the doctor if they feel ill because they can't afford the high deductible on their insurance? I don't care who is in office. If they don't give a guarantee to the most vulnerable, can you just cut for a second? Okay. I don't care who is in office. If they don't give a guarantee to the most vulnerable people, then they will get financial support. They can stay home or go to the doctor. We are not going to stop the spread of the virus.
Yeah, I mean, one possibility is that the government could just send, you know, a $2,000 check every month to every person in the U.S. to help them battle this more in affected communities. But yeah. I don't see the political will or understanding of how economic policy works for that to even come to fruition.
I'm afraid that this is where you're going to really see socialized medicine in action. Again, I have military health care.
Good.
Step into – yeah, I agree with you.
Seriously.
Because people are going to respond to this by going to the emergency room.
Right.
And you're going to have to see massive material outlay, medical expertise. Who knows whether the Army or National Guard might have to get involved to help with medical triaging and those things. I don't know. It's important that we understand that this is going to affect us in ways that I don't think it's affected us
and
before.
That we all get the same access to health care that members of Congress get.
We only have a few moments and about 13 or 14 minutes. So I want to spend some time because tomorrow is the South Carolina primary.
What?
And we're seeing a whole bunch of different polls coming out, and it's a tight race, and it should be interesting to see what happens tomorrow. Thank the Lord, it is not a caucus; it's an actual primary, so that'll be interesting. Malcolm, you just came from South Carolina. Yeah. What was your impression?
Well, as many of you know, my family's from South Carolina. I went to visit relatives down there. I was just in Ladson and Jedburgh and stayed in Charleston. And let me tell you, I think it's great that Bernie did well up here in the Northeast, but South Carolina is Biden country. And amazingly, Tom Steyer, if you turn on the TV and you go to MSNBC, believe me, every third ad is from Tom Steyer and the fourth is from Bloomberg. So he has,
and Bloomberg's not on the ballot in South Carolina.
No, he's flooding the zone. Yeah. So in South Carolina, you've got this strange dynamic where Steyer has 11% of the vote. He's equal to Bernie Sanders as of the Monmouth poll this morning, which is pretty amazing. But it shows the power of large quantities of
money.
Ducats, right? That's money, and in these communities, particularly out in the college towns.
So what happens, let's say the polls, at least most of the polls are right, Alan, and Biden wins, and say he wins by 4 or 5 percentage points in South Carolina. What does that mean for Super Tuesday?
Well, I'm fascinated by this whole thing right now because I just don't know what the intervening variable is going to be in the form of the coronavirus. So Bernie was heading towards a very big victory before. I think overwhelming in terms of California. He was leading in the polls and doing all of that. I think this may be a game changer. I'll be honest with you. I think this may be a game changer. The very good commentary we heard earlier today from a number of you, which is you really do need a leader who has some plans and who knows what they can do in this kind of situation. I think it helps Biden a great deal.
It's South Carolina. It's one state.
No. I agree with that.
I mean,
I agree with that. It is one state. It is South Carolina. Biden was ahead. He was expected to win by just a little. But I think when you're looking for a leadership, an experiential base, that makes a big difference.
Well, I think the test will, I'm sorry, okay, Judith. Okay. I think the test will be obviously Super Tuesday, with California being the big one, and then the swing states, the Rust Belt states. And I'm very happy to see, and I wish I could go, that Bernie Sanders and Public Enemy are playing a concert in L.A. on March 1st. Fight
well,
the power.
Well, you know, I'm so sorry to say this, but you have leaks about Nancy Pelosi being concerned about losing the House if Bernie is the candidate. Now, I don't know how legitimate that is and whether it's true or not, but if it is, can you imagine what would go on in this country if you went back to a Republican Senate, a Republican House, and a Republican President?
Well, if I can comment on that, because I got excoriated the other day by finally coming out for Biden and saying the risk of this is that we could lose both here. The House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, the presidency forever. And, of course, you allow a autocrat to become a permanent dictator if Donald Trump were to win. This is not a time of revolution. This is a time of where America has to go back to what it was. Bernie has about 25 to 30% of the Democratic Party. The remainder is divided up amongst four or five candidates.
The problem with that argument is it's not factually correct. If you look at the polls, including in swing states, which candidate has the best chance of beating Trump, virtually all of them do. And Bernie does very, very well in a matchup against Trump in swing states. In Pennsylvania, working class voters are interested.
I'm writing an article right now for Newsweek about the coming swift boating of Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And the few videos that we've seen of him where he was talking up socialism in the Soviet Union and blah, 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 and how great the trains were, that's the least of what's coming. This man was under continuous surveillance by the KGB. And the former KGB officer that runs Russia is going to produce all of that material we've never seen.
Listen,
and the Trump campaign,
red baiting has never worked. Starting now in the Democratic primary. And Bernie has faced red baiting his entire career, and it doesn't stick.
Bernie's not a communist. He's not a socialist.
He's
not talking about central planning. He's talking about getting the United States up to a level with the rest of the industrialized world in terms of sensible health care policy, sensible policies to deal with inequality, and sensible education and infrastructure investment.
Yay, but he can't.
That's not a revolution, Malcolm. That's catching up with the rest of the world.
Getting the plurality versus the majority are two different things.
Who cares?
Yeah, well, see? Yeah, but you got to win, which is the majority, not the plurality. We can enjoy your comment, but actually, here, the moderate track is now being split up by Bloomberg, Biden, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, a good piece of it is Warren, right, who I would argue is more in that camp than in Bernie's camp, and that what constitutes the remainder of the delegates.
I don't know that, I've never thought of Warren as
half and half.
Yeah, I've always thought that Warren and
I like her, actually.
Bernie are really pretty aligned.
She would be my number two choice. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, what happened there? Why isn't she, I mean, is she the next candidate or what if Bernie loses? Because their politics are not very much different. She's highly intelligent and has accomplished quite a lot. So what happened?
Well, Bernie had years to prepare for his presidential run. I think he put together a formidable grassroots operation. I think you're absolutely right, Kate. They're quite similar, but certainly I think Warren is a bit more moderate. She actually set up the Consumer Financial Services Agency, got stuff done to answer the criticism of what has Bernie done other than provide pivotal ethical and moral leadership for the country for the last 40 years. But I am surprised by Warren not doing as well. But I think we'll know a whole lot more Tuesday night. I think South Carolina is important. Malcolm, I think you're right. I think Biden's going to do very, very well there. It'll give him some momentum. But the conversation on the roundtable Wednesday morning will be really interesting.
Thank you for the plug for Wednesday's show. I'm looking forward to that. But you know, going back to Alan's point, which I think is a really important one, which is, you know, again, a couple of days ago we weren't talking about, even in the debate, they weren't talking about coronavirus as much as they are. And Alan's point of this being a game changer, you do, I mean, this is going to be on the minds of people going to the polls on Tuesday morning and Tuesday afternoon.
As it should be.
Yes, absolutely. All right. I also want to talk about when it comes to some of these issues, and specifically, well, actually, hold that. Let me go to a couple of letters because I realize that we just have 5 minutes. I forgot we were stopping. So hold that for a second. We'll go to letters. Cindy writes, another thing I think is driving the youth is we are now seeing the first groups of students who have spent all of their school years practicing drills to protect themselves from shooters. What does that do to one's psyche? I can't imagine, except they want radical change in this country. Add that to student debt and climate change, and you can see where their desire for radical change comes from. That from Cindy.
Wait. You mean to say, are you saying that the reason that we have these shootings is because people want radical change in the same way as these progressive topics?
No, she's saying that because these kids have spent all of their lives practicing drills to protect themselves from shooters, what impact does that have on them? Because they have all of this. They have student debt. They have the prospect that they're going to be shot in school and climate change.
My bad. Thank you.
Yeah. Yep.
And they grew up at 9/11.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or even after.
It's an excellent letter.
Another component is they don't have the depth of cultural and historical knowledge and experience that a lot of oldsters like me in our 50s have. And we you know, they're a little more ideological in the pie in the sky, and that's wonderful. That's great. Good. Great part of youth.
Aspirational.
Yeah, that's what kids are for.
Greg writes and says, responding to Malcolm, why is it that it's always the left side of the party that has to bend and give in to a less preferred candidate? It's been 40 years since the moderate side bent a little, and the result is a country much further right wing than ever. Time for moderates to compromise instead of just demanding compromise from the left.
Because we're the majority? Just guessing. Average people want average things, and you know, progress is incremental. It is not revolutionary as you would like.
Yeah,
it to
but
be.
Even if you elect,
especially when you talk about African Americans, right?
Even if you elect a moderate Democrat, depending on the composition of Congress, any compromise is going to be stonewalled. You saw that with Obama. Nothing's going to change if it's Bernie or a moderate in office. They're going to be, you can't compromise with a party that's not willing to compromise.
Yeah, the right,
and that's the problem.
You're right. The right has gone extremely to the right, and what we would call, you know, the left is actually pretty center right.
Yeah.
I mean, so but that's the nature of democracy, right?
Susan writes to us and says, I agree with Mr. Nance that the Republicans will massively play up the socialist thing. We know his views are correct and altruistic, but the swing voters, the unintelligent and uninformed, will swallow it hook, line, and sinker. Says
Trump,
Susan.
Trump's going to go after every single Democratic candidate.
But
you know, if 10 years ago you kicked your dog, that's going to be an ad.
But the lethality of this theme is murderous. I mean, it will stick. it will be the worst swift voting in American political history. And you know what? The people that are that we are trying to get, those middle of the roads and those people who are independent or may have voted for a Republican but not Trump, they're going to say, well, what's the alternative? And that whole communist versus Trump thing was the theme of CPAC this week.
They're not going to vote for Trump. Just I think we need to stop being pundits for a moment and just think of people who everyone has their favorite Democratic candidate in the race. And if your candidate doesn't win, you're going to show up
we're
and vote
about
for the
Dems,
other
we're talking
Democrat.
About everybody else.
We got the governor coming up in just a second and getting on the line. So I want to Jesus.
I love it.
We have Aaron, you've got a plug?
Yeah, so my bluegrass band Big Stone Gap is playing with Eastbound Jesus on Saturday at the Vermont Arts Exchange Basement Music Series. It's going to be held in the Bennington Brush Building at 190 North Street in Bennington, Vermont. The doors are at 7 and the show is at 8, and there will be food and libations.
Oh, I want you to come perform at our theater.
It's a huge...
Hit me up.
Eastbound
okay.
Jesus is amazing, as
cool
are
name.
You all, I must say.
Thank you.
Judas, what have you got going on?
Mine's a little bit more wonky.
Okay, that's okay.
I'm giving a presentation.
That's all right. Bring a band.
Planet or Plastic, Moving Beyond Plastics, this Tuesday 5 p.m. SUNY New Paltz Lecture Center, free and open to the public. There'll be no music, but I could hum.
Okay, Kate's going to have her...
I want you to come and present it at one of our theaters.
Kate has a great a plug, but she'll be making it at 11 yeah. o'clock. And Malcolm, what do you got? Anything?
I got nothing until first week of April.
Okay, all right. Very good.
Malcolm, you'll be with us for sure.
Alan will be, and Alan will be back in just a second with the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo. Thanks to everybody. We'll be right back.